Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell, and today we're going to be talking to a geologist, a professor of geology, whose actual interests are in seismology. That's the sort of technology and the science that looks at rumblings under the ground. Our guest today is Brian Stump, professor of geology, as I mentioned, at SMU down there in Dallas. And welcome to Science Studio, Brian.
Well, thanks for having me over.
Now, before we get into, you know, what's entertaining about seismology, why it's still an active research area, an active area in general, tell us, how did Brian Stump become a scientist? What was the formative activities in your life that made you what you are?
I grew up in a small town in the Central Valley of California, farming town. And I can remember the first night that Sputnik went over. We had a bunch of kids in the neighborhood, and there were a group of 25 people that went out at night. And the imagination of seeing something come across the sky that was human-made captured my imagination. And from there, summer chemistry classes, exploding things in the garage, you know, working with their hands, building things as kids. You know, I became curious about the world around me.
It's just amazing how many scientists of a certain age have that same response.
I mean, I can remember that night.
Yeah, I remember at school we all went outside. We didn't see it at school because it was during the daytime.
Yes.
But they broadcast a beep, beep, beep. The best thing that ever happened to American science was the Russian Sputnik. We've got to thank them for this.
Well, your imagination. I mean, just what could be done?
Yeah, right.
And then in sixth grade, I had a teacher who loved fossils. And we went out and collected fossils. And holding in your hand a shark's tooth that's millions
of years
old.
You actually found yourself.
Yes.
Wow.
Was, you know, and there's history there.
Yeah.
And I guess maybe that's why, you know, I followed in the earth sciences, did physics, but then went to do earth sciences.
Okay. And so you're into seismology.
Yes. Study
so
of
tell them all. Tell the audience. what seismology?
Well, seismology are waves in the earth. And so the question is, what generates those waves? Understanding earthquakes, how big they are, where they occur. But then those same waves to try to image the earth's interior and understand what the subsurface of the earth looks like. You know, places that we can't go.
Right. So you have to have a lot of modeling for this.
I mean, yes.
You
and
just
so
can't
it,
go down to
that's
prove
exactly
that
right.
You're correct.
And I think that's what generates my interest is, you know, there's a theoretical modeling aspect of this, computers, but there's data acquisition. I actually enjoy going out and putting seismic instruments around the world.
Well, that's the best thing about geologists. I mean, they're always out somewhere.
Well,
and it's never at Kmart or Walmart. It's, you know, Peru or somewhere really totally interesting.
Well, we did an experiment about 5 years ago in northeast China, and we had a number of instruments put out. And you always hire somebody or there's some money that helps somebody watch the instrument, change the batteries for you. And so one of the sites we went to was a family, and they were exactly the same age as my wife and I. And I don't speak Chinese, but in talking with them, they had one daughter, and she was gone now. She was 27 years old. She was either a captain or a major in the Army. She wasn't going to come home again. Learning about that culture is a great benefit of being a scientist.
Right. Now, when you say that you're hiring people to look after the equipment, you just have a limited time period when
these equipment you're going to put into the field, there are batteries that need to be replaced and that kind of thing. And so, you know, you're working with collaborators in China, but you're not going to go out and look at that instrument every month. And so you have somebody that helps you with the battery changes and things like that.
So tell us. I mean, I think most people think of seismology as In the sense of what I understand, looking at the interior of the earth,
mm-hmm.
you will set off sometimes a charge
yes,
and then monitor the response from that. Is that the way this study was? Or
No. This was looking for earthquakes. So in this case, we were in an area that has earthquakes. Some of them had been large historically, but the fault systems weren't very well understood. So we were looking at smaller earthquakes with instruments that were closer to the fault. But then at the same time, we were recording earthquakes from thousands of kilometers away, and those waves would help us understand the crust and upper mantle, the top part of the earth
right.
in this region.
So how long does that type of an experiment last? I mean, in a sense, you give it up or you stop the study once you think you've got enough data to do the interpretation
yes.
of the substructure.
Yes, and so you're talking about 2, maybe 3 years kind of for a deployment, if you're lucky. Fortunately for us in seismology, we have a consortium called IRIS that supplies instruments for all the
international
researchers. Yes, it's Independent Research Institutes in Seismology. And it's kind of like the library. You check out the instruments, you use them, you bring the instruments back in good shape, and they get checked out to somebody else.
Ah, so where is all that kept? Or is it different locations around
the world? Well, the Instrument Center is in Socorro, New Mexico. And then the Instrument Center, where all the data goes, and then the data becomes freely available, is in Seattle, Washington.
That's just a North American depot.
Well, but anybody that, you know, I had collaborators in China, so we were working side by side, so they have access to the data as well.
No, but I mean, do they actually have access to the instrumentation?
Without
a collaboration?
Without a collaboration. I think normally they have to have a collaboration.
Okay, right. And who funds that?
National Science Foundation.
So it's a permanent sort of resident of equipment.
Yeah, 25 years ago, the seismological community said this is kind of crazy for all of us, every university to own their own instruments.
Right.
The group came together, and it's really changed the way our science works.
Well, I mean, it's the same in chemistry, where we use big magnetic resonance equipment. It used to be that, you know, if you wanted a really big one, well, it was extraordinarily expensive for a local lab to get one. So there was a National Science Center, National Science Foundation centers. But now the instruments have come much cheaper, you know, mass production almost.
Yes.
And so I remember in Colorado State University in Fort Collins, they have a national center, National Science Foundation.
Yeah.
But I don't know if it's still as important as it was because of the cheaper. Mm-hmm. Now, is the same thing in your area?
Yeah.
Modern technology, the instrumentation is getting smaller and smaller.
It's smaller and smaller, more channels, more data, more instruments on the ground, and they're more reliable. The other part of IRIS is they operate the global seismic network with the USGS, the United States Geological Survey, in a collaborative way. So those are permanent stations. About 160 around the world. Whenever there's an earthquake, those are the stations that are used to do immediate location and magnitude determination.
So try and tell us in a lay term. Okay, there's an earthquake in Peru, and you're up in northeastern China.
Mm-hmm.
But obviously the signals go all the way around, and you will sooner or later get those signals.
Yes.
Now, when you get the signals, what is it that you can do to talk about the local
substructure
as opposed to the structure in Peru or wherever it's gone through en route?
All right. Well, maybe an easy way to step back is there's two kinds of waves we use. One are called body waves, and they travel through the interior of the Earth. And then there are surface waves that are trapped along the surface. So both of those waves will tell something different about the Earth. In terms of the body waves, what we want to see is how long does it take to get there? How are the amplitudes changed? Are there any reflections or things like that that might come from right close to the surface? And so we can interpret those to determine the thickness, the velocities, any lateral heterogeneity or two- or three-dimensional structure. And then that's complemented by the surface waves, which come later. And they really focus on those shallow layers.
So the surface, simply because it's further away, going around the circumference, automatically takes longer.
Longer, and they travel at a slower velocity as well.
Why is that?
Well, because those surface layers have lower – in general, velocity increases as we move down in the Earth. And so the body waves, since they travel deep in the Earth and then come back, part of their path is very fast.
Okay.
So they arrive earlier.
So what did you learn about the substructure in northeastern China?
Well, we learned a little bit about the depth of the MOHO and
Tell us about MOHO?
The MOHO. So that's kind of the crust mantle boundary. So that tells us about the crust mantle boundary, which in our area was about 35 to 37 kilometers. And that's of interest in that region because as we move from the west to the east, we come closer to a plate boundary. And we'd like to understand how crustal structure changes as plates bump into each other and slide past each other. Because that's going to control, in some sense, some of the earthquakes that we see, what depth the earthquakes occur
at. I mean, we're sitting here in West Texas. How far is the MOHO from where we sit downwards?
It's a little shallower and probably has a little lower velocity than what we saw in that part of China. And one reason is because we're in the southern extent of the Rio Grande Rift.
Right.
And so we see that that history of that beginnings of a new plate boundary.
How does that distance vary in all different places? Where is the place on Earth where the boundary
where's the thinnest?
Is the closest?
In the oceans. In the oceans. Because the ocean crust may be as thin as 8 kilometers, maybe even a little thinner. Thickest is wherever we have two big continents bumping into each other.
So which the Himalaya.
The Himalayas, exactly.
Right.
And so we can go, and I won't get the numbers exactly right,
no,
we can go anywhere from 8 to maybe 90 kilometers in thickness.
Okay, so where people live, on the crustal boundaries of the oceans, is that also
It depends on if you're on the ocean or the continent side.
Right.
And so like in California, you're in the continental side, so it's going to be on the thicker side rather than the thinner side.
And how would you know if you didn't do these measurements? Is there anything special about being close to the core? Is it easier to get geothermal energy?
You're actually not very close to the core because these distances are so small compared to the distance, the radius of the Earth, which
right.
is over 6,300 kilometers. So, there's there's other kinds of measurements, heat flow measurements, gravity, magnetics, resistivity measurements. There's a variety of remote sensing, all which go into these integrated models.
So when you look at a sort of a geological map, I remember there was a beautiful book by, I think it's Simon Chichester. It was called The Map That Changed the Earth. And
the
it was
Earth,
all
yes.
about the
yeah,
very
he's had
first.
A number. He's had a book about Krakatoa and also about the San Francisco 1906 earthquake.
Okay. But, it was just fascinating that the very first geological
came
out of the need to build canals.
And you began to look at the subsurface.
Right.
You began to think about what the implications
were. It's Simon
were.
Winchester.
Winchester,
that's his name.
That's right.
But it's a great book,
yes.
a great read.
Yes, because it kind of gives you the human component also of science.
So we obviously know the topography of the Earth.
Mm-hmm.
We got satellites now that have helped us look at regions we never went to.
Mm-hmm.
But what do we know about this underground area, the crustal material? What do we know about that?
We're learning more and more. There's an ongoing large-scale experiment called EarthScope right now, which is GPS measurements. It's seismometers, a set of 400 seismometers that are sweeping across the United States. They're kind of in the central part of the United States right now, going from Canada down to Mexico.
So it's like the combine harvesters
exactly. I use an example. It's like leapfrog. When I was a kid, we played leapfrog. So
right.
the instruments start in California, and then some of them leapfrog and move to the next, and they move all the way across the United States, and then they'll go to Alaska. And they're in terms of the seismometers, they're about every 70 kilometers apart. And so this provides unprecedented spatial sampling. And we're beginning this isn't my area. I'm more about earthquake sources and things. But the community is beginning to build these wonderful three-dimensional images of the crust and upper mantle to try to understand what's the difference between the western United States, the Rocky Mountains. Also, we're seeing smaller earthquakes than we've seen. There was a little magnitude 4.3 earthquake in Norman, Oklahoma, and was felt all the way down into Dallas. In fact, I got a call from the—
Felt on the surface by people or by instruments?
By people.
Right, because instruments can find it anywhere.
And so these smaller size, of course, 4 is big enough that it would have been seen by the national network anyway, but as we have more and more stations, we're going to see smaller and smaller earthquakes. We're going to understand more about seismicity across the United States, as well as this three-dimensional structure.
What's the biggest surprise that has come out of such studies? If you had to say, wow, this has changed the paradigm that we're operating under.
I think one thing is that we're beginning to see earthquakes, or at least earthquake activity, that occurs on frequencies and timescales that we had never thought about. And this is maybe in the last 5 to 10 years. There's a number of names for them. Some of them are called episodic tremors. In the Pacific Northwest and in Japan, there have been some groundbreaking studies, but because of more and more dense instrumentation, that show these kind of earthquake storms that move.
So there's a periodicity.
And they move up and down the faults over weeks and months.
Is that aiding in prediction?
It may. It looks like some of this activity occurs below the brittle part of the fault, closer to the ductile part of the fault, and its relationship to the brittle part of the fault and when earthquakes catastrophically fail. I don't understand. I think we're beginning to think that there may or may not, I don't know, but there may be some relationships. But these are kinds of events that 10 years ago we hadn't seen.
You're listening to Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell. We're talking to Professor Brian Stump, Professor of Geology with particular emphasis on seismology from Southern Methodist University in Dallas. We shall be back.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. David Neisel.
And I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog. I wish I could blame my bad dancing on a condition called beat deafness, which was first documented only 5 years ago. Dave, I know you can relate.
Oh, it's bad. My poor wife. Sadly, we can't blame our clumsiness on beat deafness because it's a type of musical brain disorder that's extremely rare. We can follow a beat. It's our limbs that just don't cooperate.
Researchers identified a 26-year-old man who, when listening to music, could not follow the beat at all. He loves music, sings on pitch, but has no rhythm.
So then, what is rhythm? It consists of several temporal elements, such as pattern, meter, and tempo. These different elements of rhythm have been mapped to shared as well as uniquely distributed neural systems by brain scans.
So it seems like a simple task, such as tapping your foot to a tune, is actually quite a complex and little understood process. It appears only humans can process meter, while other species may be able to process pattern and perhaps tempo.
Studies have also determined that distinct and distributed neural systems are involved in sensing and processing other elements of music, such as melody, harmonies, and timbre.
But our neural processing of rhythm is only the beginning of a person's ability to dance to it. That involves orchestrated movements that start in the motor cortex, then travel down 20 million nerve fibers in the spinal cord to an arm, a finger, or any precise body part, telling it how to move.
Is it any wonder that some people are better dancers than others? Researchers plan to do further studies on the young man to find the genetic basis for his beat deafness.
We are Drs. David Niesel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries shape the future of medicine. For much more and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell, Brian Stump from SMU, talking about seismology. And you were talking about this relatively recent sort of finding of a periodicity or frequency. And that's really quite interesting. I mean, is that something that anybody had suggested many, many years ago, and now it's coming to fruition, or is it a completely...
I guess in my opinion that probably there are people who have talked about these things, but I don't know. I can't tell you who those people are. But I do think it tells us that we need to understand faults and fault surfaces, both in the brittle and the ductile regions, and that we need to think broadly about...
How do you have a fault in a ductile region?
Well,
explain the terms for the audience.
A fault is a boundary, right. A boundary between plates. And essentially, in the brittle region, we're going to store elastic energy in that brittle region, and that energy may be stored over 200 years or 250 years because the plates are moving, but they're not moving along that plate boundary. And then in the course of a few seconds or minutes, maybe longer if it's a bigger earthquake, all that energy is going to be relieved and seismic waves are going to be generated.
And earthquakes occur.
And earthquakes, 1906
big
San
ones.
Francisco earthquake, yes. But a ductal region is a region that can slip and can move in a more continuous way. From this brittle to ductile and understanding that transition, that's all part of this boundary. And it's all about the stresses that are on those boundaries. And we need some clues about what drives that brittle failure because that's that big earthquake.
Right.
And if we could do that, then we could make some predictions.
Where could you point to us as an area of the ductile sort of fault region?
In the Pacific Northwest, underneath the area from, Vancouver down to Oregon or some of the places where at depth where these things – this isn't my area of research, but it's I follow it from afar. But that's one of the areas. I think the early work was done in Japan and now in other places around the world.
Okay. Well, let's get on to your particular area of earthquakes and the sort of the signature in seismology of an earthquake compared to, for example, a big nuclear explosion underground. Do they have clear fingerprints?
They have clear fingerprints. When we have an earthquake, you can think of two pieces of plate that move and slide past each other, there's shearing motion that's associated with those. When that happens, there are two kinds of waves that they generate. They generate P waves, which are just like the waves in my voice. So they're compressional waves that travel through the earth. But they also generate shear waves. Earthquakes are very efficient at generating shear waves. On the other hand, my real simple model of an explosion is think about a balloon that I've blown up and there's energy that's in that balloon, and I take a pin and break that, boom, I've got compressive energy, but I don't get much shear energy.
Okay.
And so one of the things you want to look at is the amount of P to shear Of course, explosions are complicated things, so they do generate shear waves, but not
well, I mean,
as much.
I presume. Are there evidence for underground nuclear explosions ever having created secondary earthquakes, for example?
I think often, and particularly back in the 60s and 70s when a number of countries around the world were testing large nuclear explosions, following the nuclear explosions, there'd be a whole sequence of small earthquakes that would follow because there are little faults. Yeah. And what you're seeing is a redistribution. You've disturbed the stress field.
Yeah.
They were at least a factor of maybe 10 to 100 smaller, probably 100 smaller than the explosion itself. So they're not big earthquakes.
On the Richter scale, okay, of earthquakes and things of this nature, mm-hmm. a nuclear explosion is what in the region where it would take place?
Well, the magnitude scale is region independent because you always make a distance correction. So.
Right.
But typically in the 70s when we were testing at 150 kilotons, a kiloton is 2 million pounds of explosives.
So
that's a lot of explosives. At those ranges, a typical magnitude might be magnitude 6. Magnitude 6 is enough to do moderate damage.
Going back to it then, the very fact that these big ones created aftershocks, if you like, that must have led to the concept of using nuclear weapons on fault lines to do a progressive breaking of this pressure that was building up.
I
read that some people had this idea.
I don't know that that ever really was a serious consideration because, this is the reason, when you go from magnitude 7 to magnitude 6, that's 10 times the amplitude, 30 times of energy. And so it would take 30 magnitude 6s to equal magnitude 7. So let's say that you really wanted to relieve the fault in California of a magnitude 7. That means you have to have all of those magnitude 6s. That's a difficult engineering problem. Plus you've used a nuclear explosion.
Right, N number
and
of nuclear
how
explosions.
Do you know you might not trigger a magnitude 7 or a magnitude 7.5? And so
right.
in terms of engineering an earthquake,
I don't think there was
ever any serious consideration of that.
Okay. What brought you into that area of studying earth science?
I guess I was interested in understanding all kinds of seismic events, earthquakes and explosions. But the one interesting thing about explosions, and not nuclear explosions, but you can do small chemical explosions, is you can do scaled experiments. And so you can develop a theory, and you can go out and do a field experiment and gather data, model that data, and see if your ideas are correct or that they need to be modified.
And so that's what you do? Do you have graduate students going out
there? That's one of the things we've done,
right.
we've done over the years. And so, but we've also studied earthquakes. And actually, more recently, we've begun to study acoustic waves in the atmosphere, what we call infrasound. So low-frequency acoustic waves, 100 seconds to 20 hertz.
In the atmosphere?
In the atmosphere.
Caused by the earthquakes?
Yes, because if you think about it, earthquakes, man-made events, are often close to the interface between the solid earth and the atmosphere.
Right.
And so they're going to partition energy in both. So why don't we just study both in terms of trying to understand the phenomenology?
But does that energy travel long distances?
Yes.
So I mean the weather patterns and
the weather patterns
stuff,
have a big effect. That's one of the things we're beginning to discover. So it makes for a very interesting ability to understand the atmosphere as well as the source.
Tell us a little bit about nuclear explosions again. I mean, people, apart from the North Koreans, I don't think anyone's been doing this for the last 10 years.
Fortunately not. We have a comprehensive test ban treaty out there that a number of countries have signed but not ratified. So so there hasn't been much testing. But as you say, in 2006 and 2009, the North Koreans apparently tested.
And were you involved in that? I mean, apart from just
professional curiosity. I mean, I think we all look at the data. We all collect data. And so we record these kinds of events. And part of the global system of instrumentation around the world will always measure these kinds of events.
I mean, and I don't remember this, but I mean, clearly after the explosions and, you know, people around the world like yourself and others just say, nuclear explosion in North Korea.
Because of the magnitude.
How long did they deny it?
The size of the event. I don't know that I followed it carefully, but I don't know that they ever denied it.
Okay. No, I mean, but sometimes people do deny the most blatant truths.
Yes, yes, yeah. And I'm probably not as good of a follower of what the North Koreans say, but I don't believe they ever denied it.
Okay. So in terms of nuclear testing, is there a team in North America that is constantly involved in that?
Yeah, and in fact, as you said, people like me, some of our funding comes from sources that are interested in the basic seismology.
Right.
We can go back to 1960. The Defense Department invested a lot of money in putting 120 seismic stations around the world. Part of that was to measure nuclear explosions. But those 120 stations began locating earthquakes, and those earthquake locations contributed to our understanding of plate tectonics.
Right.
So that kind of synergy where basic science is supported within National Science Foundation, Defense Department, Department of Energy, then feeds back to these kinds of things.
So let's think about that other type of experiment they talked about at the beginning, where you actually put an explosion somewhere because you're looking for particular patterns underneath, perhaps oil producing
whatever. You know, the oil and gas, they do use small explosions sometimes to image the subsurface. And we as geophysicists—
But that's just a local sort of observation, if you like. It wouldn't be very much use if you're in Otago in New Zealand or something.
But when the big underground nuclear explosions were being tested, those were very good sources.
Well, that's what I was going to get to. Is there an intellectual argument today that says, look, we're not going to test nuclear weapons, but we have some, and it would be very conducive to advancing the field if we were given permission to have underground nuclear explosions, you know, with international controls, simply to learn more about the science of seismology and the tectonic plates, et cetera?
I think we've become more efficient at using smaller sources for imaging the crust and upper mantle. We have more sophisticated instruments and quieter locations. And so I think we do quite well, even with understanding. We were talking about plate boundaries and crust and upper mantle.
Right.
I think that we can use conventional sources to do most of that kind of work that we do today.
And as you mentioned, you're seeing much more smaller earthquakes.
Much smaller events, and so you're really refining your – so I think the days are past of needing the large nuclear explosion. Now, some of my colleagues may argue that we do.
No, but I mean that sounds quite commonsensical. I mean, as you get more and more sophisticated instrumentation, you know, the need for the big – initial input becomes lesser and lesser.
You know, when I go to the doctor and have an X-ray done, they don't expose me to as much energy as they used to.
Going back to magnetic resonance, you know, I mean, where we used to use half a gram, now we can use 10 milligrams. And so it works out. What are your future goals? What is there one particular project that you're working on now that you think
I'm really curious about this, the infrasound. And in particular, I think one of my interests are the infrasonic waves that travel between 10 and maybe 500 kilometers. There's a contribution from the troposphere, the first 40 kilometers of the Earth, and also higher in the atmosphere. Understanding what those waves might allow us to say about the time variations of those in two, three dimensions, and how that might be useful to the atmospheric community. So it's reaching out to other communities.
So, I mean, is this fitting in somehow to climate also?
I'm not absolutely sure if it is, but certainly we see temporal variations on the order of days, maybe sometimes hours.
Okay. So, I mean, basically it's a new field with a new detection process.
It's an old field.
So who knows where it's going to lead?
That's right. It's an old field that in the 60s, when there was atmospheric testing, there were lots of infrasound measurements. But after all the testing went underground, all those instruments were taken out. And there's become a kind of a renewed interest now in these things.
Brian Stump, professor of geology, seismologist, SMU, thank you very much for being on Science Studio. Great fun.
Well, it was good fun for me too. Thanks.
Okay, lovely. And Norma Martinez, we thank you as always for putting this together. Come back next week. There'll be another Science Studio. And this is Keith Pannell. Bye-bye.